2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California. It's time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today on Geek Speak, after a spot of geek news, we're speaking with Firefox web browser expert and author Nigel McFarlane. Nigel McFarlane has written Firefox Hacks by O'Reilly, and we'll be talking all about that wonderful web browser and the neat tricks and talents you can do with it. During the second half of the show, I welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half an hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Geek Sean Cleveland, Senior PR Marketing Manager for NetCell. Sean, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Hello.
Before we get into our conversation about Firefox browser, which is a wonderful browser you and I both use, with the author of Firefox Hacks, Nigel McFarlane, from Australia, actually, a long-distance conversation we'll be having soon, let's get into some news, some geek news. Sean?
Yeah. Kind of a big week this week. Microsoft announced Windows XP 64-bit version of their operating system a little early. I don't know if you recall, about 3 weeks, a month ago, they made a beta available, and you could download it, and you'd have 360 days
play
with it. Yeah, they pulled all that in, and they announced Windows 64-bit client version of Windows XP Professional today at WinHack this week. WinHack is in Seattle. It's the Windows Hardware Engineering Conference.
Makes sense for them to make an announcement there. Does this really affect most users?
No. In fact, Bill Gates said he doesn't expect 64-bit Windows to take off until 2007, really. But, you know, actually 2006, he said, with the release of Longhorn, which will come in both 32 and 64-bit flavors. And he did talk a little about Longhorn, too. He said so far the operating system's, you know, more like an all-or-nothing experience. It will configure itself more like the games do today. So it's supposed to be easier to use.
Hmm.
But the system requirements could be a little more hefty. They recommend a new discrete graphics card, something powerful, and so that you can take advantage of cool graphics.
Which is so vital in an operating system, really.
And these cool graphics will be, you know, scaled back if your video card can't support it. But if you have a really nice cutting-edge card, supposedly Longhorn's going to look beautiful, probably like a Macintosh today. And you're going to need at least 512 megs of memory to run it.
Well, memory's cheap.
512 megs.
So, but they did release the 64-bit version of XP Professional,
right.
Which is probably very much in line with the new dual cores and dual processors being released
by
Intel and AMD. So it makes sense for them to do that.
And keep in mind that this 64-bit version is fully compatible with 32-bit operating systems and software. So you could buy a 64-bit, one of the new 64-bit Athlon 64 processors or the Intel dual core,
mm-hmm.
and you can you don't have to install a 64-bit version of Windows. You can just install Windows XP and your regular software. But you wouldn't be taking advantage of the 64-bit chip. So, you know, but you can upgrade later at your convenience. So, kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thanks for that. I did want to make one comment about that. We're seeing the growth of the 64-bit operating systems out there, but we're not seeing a lot of the apps that everybody uses all the time to be 64. So, 64-bit. So, I'm assuming with Microsoft doing this, you'll start seeing more, you know, Adobe releases of their products and things
right.
of that nature.
The supporting
the 64 that will really take advantage of those dual processors.
And I think what you'll see is the same software.
Yeah, the same software, just compiled again for taking.
It'll work in 32-bit, but if you have 64, then you can take advantage of the increased performance.
Right. Well, thank you for that story.
You know, I heard that Tiger, is that Apple 10.4?
The new system, that's right, yeah.
Is going to support 64-bit, too.
That's right. So Macintosh is doing the same thing. Now, of course, Macintosh has actually had 64-bit machines out for a while with the G5s.
So we should get an Apple.
It's very hard to get Apple reps out, and I'm not sure exactly why. It's probably better to get, you know, authors of Apple hack books and things of that nature, because Apple is pretty controlled on their PR.
So I saw this little story. I thought it was interesting. 2 weeks ago, we had Kevin Crewell, who's the editor-in-chief of Instat. He's an Instat analyst, but he's the editor-in-chief of the Microprocessor Report, talking about the Cell processor. And we talked to him about Cell. It was interesting. But now he's saying what he already said on our show 2 weeks ago. Shows you just how cutting-edge GeekSpeak is.
That's right.
He says, some have called Cell an Intel killer, which is completely ridiculous. The only place where the Cell processor can be considered competition for Intel will be where the Sony next-generation game console competes with the Media Center PC. So that chip is it's developed, you know, more to process next-generation broadband media and graphics with greater efficiency than traditional what's called RISC or CISC cores. Which are used, you know, for Macintosh and PCs. Very sloppy, out-of-order execution chips that require lots of power. Not so good for media centers and game consoles. So not going up against, Intel. So don't expect to buy a PC with a Cell processor.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here with a news story. This guy Elwood or Woody Norris is an inventor. He holds 47 U.S. patents. He's pretty applicable inventor. He holds a patent on digital handheld recording, another for hands-free headset. So, I think one of those sold for $5 million. And Norris says that really made him want to be an inventor. So you can see.
You think?
His most recent thing is something that I've been dying to make for a long time, but he made it a lot better. Probably went beyond what I was thinking, but basically he has this little box. It's called the Soundless Sound Invention. It uses hypersonic beam, which means that higher than what we can hear, a beam of sound higher than what we can hear. It beams to a person's head and then radiates normal sound in their head. So what this comes down to is if there's a room full of people and you have this little beam and you aim it at one of them, only that person can hear the music. No one else can hear it. Or what you're saying.
Oh, my gosh.
It's kind of creepy, but also kind of cool.
It's like a James Bond invention.
You can see inside in a home, you know, you point one sound source to one chair, another sound source to another chair, and it totally doesn't interfere with the two. But talk about something that might cause headaches. In any case, he just won a MIT prize for the device. And
can you imagine like a lifeguard pointing this at someone saying,
get out of the water.
Get out of the water. There's a shark behind you.
Yeah, it's kind of cool technology, but it's also kind of creepy.
So U.S. researchers said Friday in Los Angeles they developed a new electrically assist microbial fuel cell that does not require oxygen. Basically, this enables bacteria to produce four times as much hydrogen directly out of biomass that can be generated typically by fermentation alone. So people are wondering where all the hydrogen is going to come from next-generation fuel cells and cars. And it looks like service stations be making their own, possibly using these bacteria.
Are these like compost things?
And they'll use biomass. It's almost like Back to the Future, remember?
Right, yeah, yeah.
At the very end.
Rotten stuff.
Yeah, you just basically take your trash and pour it in.
Fusionizer? Mr. Fusion 2000?
Mr. Fusion,
yeah.
So, kind of interesting. Yeah. Samsung, you got one?
Yes.
Oh, go for it.
Speaking of processors and operating systems of 64-bit, the Apple just released a new G5 with a 2.7 gigahertz dual 64-bit processor. It's a lot higher for the Macintosh environment. And, of course, it includes the new version of Tiger, which was released today, yesterday, recently, anyway. And the new G5 line...
I think it's today.
Yeah, I think it is today. It also, of course, has built-in support for the Apple 30-inch Cinema HD display. Talk about a cool display. 30 inches diagonal Cinema display. Beautiful.
Oh,
and, of course,
God.
You have to have a special graphics card to run it. And, of course, the new G5s have that built in. So... pretty nice machine. Of course, it's expensive because it's a Mac, and if you got the money, then why not do it? But most people like us can't afford that.
No.
Of course, it comes with an NVIDIA GeForce 6800 Ultra DDL, which is the one that can handle that kind of size.
Right, right. Like 256 megs of memory on board.
And another thing with the Apple and supposedly Tiger, and I haven't actually run Tiger, the release, has screen rotation built into it, which means that even though Apple controls all the hardware, it wouldn't matter what hardware, the operating system itself handles the screen rotation. And there's a company out with the cinema displays have a rotating mount. So basically you can take these wide format things and turn them into page format by rotating
it,
which is really cool because when you're dealing with like publication, you know, Cork Express kind of layout stuff, any kind of layout, it's nice to be able to see an actual page of text all in one screen, and you can do that now.
That's why I got a tablet PC.
Yeah, that's why you got the new tablet. That's right.
So Samsung has shipped several serial ATA2 hard drives. They're the first manufacturer to actually produce and ship second-generation serial ATA. Now, serial ATA is a next-generation hard drive connection technology, which is really cool about this is it's serial-based, so data can travel in both directions simultaneously, unlike the old parallel ATA. A little slower, wide-ribbon cable, took up a lot of space in your computer, and wasn't good for airflow. Serial ATA uses really thin, skinny wires, and it's with the second generation, increases the overall bus width to 300 megabytes, you know, per second.
Right.
So these new drives have maximum I/O speeds of 3 gigabit per second. Kind of different way of saying it. I can't do the math in my head that quickly.
It's okay.
But basically, it doubles the bandwidth. I think that's the overall bus. Okay. So Samsung drives are available in sizes of 80, 120, and 160 gigabyte. What's really cool about serial ATA though is it's capable of daisy chaining drives. So right now you can only connect one serial ATA drive to one port. And with this serial ATA 2 and these new drives, you can actually daisy chain drives, which is kind of cool. And then Samsung showed off a hybrid hard drive.
And
what is that?
What is it?
It's very technical. I thought I would get it, but I'm looking at it going, oh my God, this is crazy. So it promises to leverage the benefits of magnetic storage and solid state storage without compromising the cost of the computer housing it.
Interesting.
So the ultra-high-density benefits of magnetic storage technology are preserved, while the lower power reliability and faster read-write access of advanced NAND, you know, basically solid-state memory technology, enhances usability in a hybrid drive to little or no cost.
I wonder if they're taking advantage of the high read rates on the drive to start caching data onto flash.
Actually, that's kind of what they're doing. It uses a 1 gigabit flash module as both a write buffer and a boot buffer.
Nice.
So in the hybrid write mode, the mechanical drive is spun down for the majority of the time while the data is written to the flash write buffer. And when that's filled,
a drive that would last a lot longer.
Yeah, when that's filled, the rotating drive spins up and uses the hard drive.
So it's kind of like a hybrid vehicle in that you have the engine only running when you really need it, and the motor takes over most.
So when you're booting your OS, you're booting off really high speed, you know, flash.
Yeah, and not having to wait for the drive to boot up.
Yeah,
spin
exactly.
Up, Seth.
Pretty cool.
Very cool. Very cool. All right. Microsoft won the browser wars of the 1990s, but the Mozilla Foundation is making a comeback now. The Mozilla Foundation is a major software organization producing mostly browsers, or that's the one we know about at least. And right now from Australia, we have author of Firefox Hacks, Tips and Tools for Next Generation Web Browsing, Nigel McFarlane, all the way from Australia. Thank you, Nigel, for joining us, and welcome to GeekSpeak.
Thanks, Lyle. Nice to meet you, too.
Now, it's, 3 a.m. in the morning there? Is that about right?
Yes. It's after the pub, after the movies, and after the nightclub.
So you haven't gotten to sleep yet?
Yeah, that's right.
Nigel is a rapid application developer. He wrote the book Rapid Application Development with Mozilla. He's done instant JavaScript, Ronx Publishing. He knows JavaScript and development in Mozilla. Kind of an expert in the Mozilla and highly active member of the Mozilla Foundation. Quickly, the Mozilla Foundation, how does the structure work? Is it a business? Is it a nonprofit? Can you tell me a little bit about that, Nigel?
Yeah, that's right. It's a charity organization and with a no-profit-making goals. This core member of the development community that actually works for the foundation, and then surrounding that core group, which is somewhere between 10 and 20 at any given time, there's a much larger and wider range of people doing all kinds of bits and pieces on the side. And I work near the foundation, but not in the foundation, if you like.
Okay.
They don't employ a documentation writer, but since there's none inside the foundation, I'm the next best thing. And then the further away you move from the foundation, the more people you find doing all kinds of bits of volunteer work or promotional work, from low-level gritty code all the way up to just simply promoting the browser to their friends.
Now, when you talk about documentation, when you document mostly by writing books, but you also do articles and such online, giving a lot of content away for free, how do you balance the making money aspect of being an author and paying your bills with the, you know, giving the information away for free?
It's sort of a bit like a stone rolling down the hill. I find that the more that I do in the Mozilla area, the easier it gets. So, for example, when I started a few years ago, just doing a little bit every week was really on top of my other working habits. But now that I've been going for a while, I just find that more and more tasks start to collect on my plate, and some of them are paid and some of them are not, and so it slowly turns into a job and then into a career, and who knows where it'll go from there.
What do you like about Firefox?
Well, I suppose I'm a bit different to some of the other programmers in the that work on the product very regularly. Because I write about the technology, I sort of have to wear two hats.
Uh-huh.
On the one hand, I have to understand what's going on deep inside the product. But then on the other hand, I have to try and remember what mere human beings sort of perceive as important on the surface. So I sort of have to answer that question twice, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
I'm quite technical, and so I really enjoy the complexity that's inside the software. It's a really big product, and you can wander around inside it for a long time. And if you're disposed in that direction, then that's a way to make a living. But just on the surface, the thing that's always attracted me to web browsers is that just that it really is simple, a simple tool in many ways. It's simpler than a word processor. It's simpler than a Microsoft Excel or spreadsheets. It's simpler than database access. The web is a simple place to be in many ways, and web browsers are really quite democratic in that respect. Even my parents know how to use them.
Yeah, that's true. They are. They do have a sense of easiness about them. Nigel, one thing I really liked about your Firefox hacks books. I'm a web developer, web developer for years, so I've got that whole JavaScript, you know, background. I understand XML, and what I'm learning about Firefox hacks, your book from O'Reilly, is that the browser itself is kind of built with this idea of that viewing source capability that we're so used to in websites. So, you know, if you go to any web page in the world and do a view source, which most browsers support, you can see how the page is created in HTML, and that feature. The original Netscape doing that allowed people to learn quite quickly how to do stuff. So people are to learn off each other very fast. One of the reasons why the web grew so quickly. I was never trained, for example, but I'm an expert in HTML. So it's about learning from other people. And what I noticed in your whole chapter in Firefox Hacks is talking about how you actually, instead of just doing the web page, but the entire application's built kind of like that, where you've got kind of configuration files that are XML documents that allow you to make a lot of changes, and the code that kind of glues the app together is JavaScript. Is that one of the reasons why it's so exciting to you to be in there, in that environment?
Yes, I think that, you know, the web development is really a growing area at the moment. Tim O'Reilly of O'Reilly Media wrote recently about the growth in that portion of the technology industry over the last 12 months, and the increasing maturity of web browsers and their increased support for standards is really turning the web environment into a more solid career option than it used to be, say, 5 years ago, when all you could do was dump a page of HTML text to the web and hope that it looked okay. The increased technical support in the browser products, not just Firefox, but elsewhere in Safari and Opera and even a little bit in Internet Explorer, it's making the web a much more professional medium to work in and a place where people's expectations about the kinds of interfaces that they're going to get is going up all the time. I think that's good for people working in the web environment. Also, when we think about open source, you know, the new kid on the block, you know, there's been sort of this mindset that if you want to be an open source person, then what you need is to get a Linux server and you need to be messing around with the command line on the Linux server using one of the numerous thousands of different products that are available now, like MySQL or the GNOME desktop, for example. We forget that open source operates in quite a large range of places now, and the web browser is a classic example. As you say, the view source feature of Firefox is a perfect way to just share your code with somebody else or share somebody else's code without really asking them. And it's another aspect in the open source phenomenon, I think, and one that's particularly suited to people that have to deal with user interfaces and real-life people.
All right, let's talk a little bit about your book breakdown. You got a whole bunch of different chapters, installation, web surfing enhancements, power tools for web developers, and I kind of think of a browser as twofold. One is the way you interface the website, the web as a viewer and a participator from a reading perspective, and the other is as a developing tool. So, you know, when you make a website, you've got to the entire time have a web browser viewing it and changing it and looking at it and seeing how it works. So of course, all people that do web development also browse and surf. So let's talk first about that web surfing enhancements section of your whole chapter with a whole bunch of tips. You talk about tab browsing. You talked about the hack number 34, for example, modified tab browsing. And we, on GeekSpeak, we're constantly talking about how tab browsing changes the way you interface with the web. Can you tell me a little bit about modifying tab browsing?
Sure. I mean, as you say, the tab browsing approach, it really changes the way you use the web. Turns people from sort of queuing up for web pages one after the other, like queuing up for a movie ticket, to a sort of a more scavenger kind of approach where you can just grab this, grab that, grab the other thing, and put them all in tabs and let it all load while you're doing something else. And people love tab browsing, but the technical people love it so much they always want to change it. Mm-hmm. And there are just so many extensions that you can add to Firefox that move it a little bit to the left or move it a little bit to the right until it works exactly the way you want it to work. For example, tab browsing preferences extension lets you easily change the way the tabs are set up. Rather than going through the standard Firefox configuration window. And I find that every day, you know, I find more extensions that are doing unusual things to tab browsing that I never expected that I'd need.
Like what?
I'd like to hear this.
Yeah, well, just yesterday even, or I think it was this week, there's a extension called Mini-T that I was fiddling with that lets you drag the tabs from across the face of each other so that you can change the order of the tabs.
Wonderful.
That's something you can't do in the standard Firefox.
Can you move them between windows?
Not yet, you can't, but just give the extension author a chance, and you never know what'll happen.
Yep, Mini-T. I see it.
One of the ones that you mentioned in your book is force links that open new windows to open in a new tab. So that's like if you're in an email client and you click on a link and it normally goes and opens a new window, it's going to open a new tab in whatever your top browser window is. Very convenient. Yeah.
Yes, I love that. Sometimes you just don't want more windows.
Yeah.
You know,
I found a lot of people don't know what extensions are, and it seems like it's kind of buried into Firefox. So to get to them, you've got to go to the Tools menu and then click on Extensions, which brings up a little dialog box, and then you click on Get More Extensions, and that takes you to them.
And let's talk a little bit more about extensions in just a minute. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com.
Later today on This American Life, yet another typical American family.
I called the bank and I said, I'm going to have to give you back this van. He said, why? I said, well, I'm on the run.
Family of eight that was on the run for 7 years, living off the land, homeschooling the kids. They're really very nice. And other stories of American limbo later today on This American Life.
Catch This American Life Sunday at 10 a.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP.
We are talking with author Nigel McFarlane about Firefox hacks, all about Firefox and the Mozilla Foundation. You're welcome to join us on Geek Speak. For questions or comments, the numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. We, Sean Cleveland and myself, Lyle Troxler, are in here, and, of course, our guest, Nigel McFarlane, is with us via phone from Australia. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KSP. You're listening to Geek Speak. This program is supported by a grant from Cruise.io, providing Internet services including DSL, spam filters, PHP, and MySQL, now with nationwide access. Information about Cruise.io membership is available online at cruise.io.com or by calling 459-6301. You can join our conversation right now. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us.
Camillo Miha, the Iraq War's first military resister who went AWOL and later turned herself in to face a year in the stockade, will tell his story Wednesday, May 4th at 7 p.m. at the Santa Cruz Veterans Hall, 846 Front Street in Santa Cruz. Tickets are available from the Resource Center for Nonviolence by calling 423-1626.
And you can call our phone numbers right now to join the conversation with Nigel McFarlane, Firefox Hacks, Mozilla developer, and, of course, in the air room with me, Sean Cleveland. The phone numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org. And we're taking your calls right now. There are no calls waiting, except for, of course, our guest, Nigel. So let's get back to extensions.
Yeah, you know, with Internet Explorer, you're pretty much stuck with what you got. You really can't increase functionality or add new features. Firefox is a whole new ballgame. I mean, there's a huge community out there who keep adding to Firefox and making it just really interesting. And extensions is part of that. And maybe, Nigel, you could tell us a little background, how all this began, because it just seems to have really taken off.
Yes, well, I think it comes from, you know, a classic tension in any software product where the more you improve it, the bigger it gets. And with a large portion of the web community still sitting behind a dial-up connection, you just can't afford to do that too much when it comes to a downloadable product. There are, you know, up to 400 extensions available now for Firefox, and if you were to put that all in a product, it would be so big that nobody would ever download it. And so it makes sense to kind of strip back to the basics and keep all of those fancy extras as just that, as extras. And that's what the product is now. And when you install the basic Firefox install, you get the features that every average person would want and a fairly clean interface that doesn't contain any other rubbish that that you might not need.
Let's talk about that rubbish for a second. And one of the things that I loved about Firefox coming out, actually wasn't, it had a few different iterations of names, but it was the standalone browser from Mozilla. When Mozilla was, you know, Netscape was in existence, and then out of that, Mozilla came out, and then Netscape was based off of Mozilla. But in general, the Mozilla browser, and it's still being developed, I think, is this giant package. It's a text, it's an HTML editor, it's a web, it's a news client, and it's an email client, and it's a browser. And talk about kind of having more than you really want. And that's the beauty of the Firefox thing, is it's just the browser. Were you involved in Mozilla Foundation when the Firefox didn't exist?
Well, it was still less than version zero when I, rather version one when I first got involved. I've been involved for several years, so I've seen it grow from its humble beginnings, and it's, you know, well before it was ever something suitable for the average consumer. So it's been very interesting to watch that happen.
I know that there was a lot of debate in the Mozilla Foundation, the group of people who are developing, whether it should be a standalone browser or kind of an all-everything kind of browser. And was that, I mean, how does the politics work in an environment where most people are volunteers?
Well, in the end, I think you can't do design by committee, no matter how hard you try. Mm-hmm. If you produce a product, you need somebody to have a vision of what it will look like in the end.
Mm-hmm.
And although Firefox is a shared development project, we have two very good technologists in Ben Goodger and the inventor of the Firefox browser, who have, you know, stick to their knitting and make sure that overall, in the biggest of big pictures, it's a smooth and easy-to-use product. And there's been, you know, a certain amount of push and shove in that respect. People have had to take a step back and say, well, okay, we'll let these user interface developers dictate the main features of the browser, and the rest of us will have to work on something else.
Mm-hmm.
I think it brings a certain clarity to the product. As you described, the Mozilla application suite, the tool that came before it, is really feature-packed. And I recall around the version 1.2 stage and subsequently, there were features that appeared and disappeared in the toolbar with every minor release because different developers couldn't make up their mind what was important or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it is important to have one or two people have the final say on what appears in front of the user's face. It's not the same as command line where there are millions and millions of different tools and everybody can add whatever they want.
Let's. I want to go to another one of the hacks for web surfing. Actually, the first hack in that chapter, use fancy bookmarks. Sean here is probably the person I know that uses bookmarks the most. Sean, why do you use so many bookmarks?
I don't know. You know, I only make bookmarks if the site's interesting to me or it's got a piece of information that I want to recall, and a lot of times I'll bury them, and I just use a search function to find. Using keywords
in your browser,
in my bookmark in the browser, uh-huh. Yeah. But you know what I found? My favorite extension for Firefox is Bookmark Synchronizer. And if you have an FTP, everyone pretty much who has an internet account like SBC Global has FTP account. And what you can do is you can have your bookmarks synchronized up to your FTP account across all your machines. And that way I have all my bookmarks with me.
So
and if I lose a machine, I never lose my bookmarks because they're always backed up on my FTP server.
Nice.
And, yeah, I have a lot of bookmarks, and I use them. I don't know. I'm just weird that way.
Nigel, what are fancy bookmarks?
There are all kinds of little features that have snuck into the bookmark system inside Firefox. And, of course, the two big ones are... keyword bookmarks and live bookmarks. If you're accustomed to using the command lines, you know, some people are much faster typers than they are warriors with a mouse. You can set up a bookmark so that you can recall a web page with a keyword just by typing it into the location bar at the top of the browser. And if you like keywords, then you'll find that in no time at all, you know, 10, 20, 50 keyword bookmarks will be in place. And all the websites that you go to very commonly you can get at just with the keyboard.
I think I might have to look into that one.
That
is really nice.
Yeah, it's very handy, and especially when you consider that, you know, really, although we wander all over the web as a matter of curiosity, we really probably all have, you know, between 5 and 10 different websites that we visit all the time. And if the more fast ways there are to get to those familiar websites, the better off we are.
Yep.
Keyword bookmarks is an example.
Keyword bookmarks, perfect example, because one of the ones I go to all the time is Google. Even though Firefox has a search feature tab in there, I like to use advanced features of Google that are a couple clicks away. So it'd be nice to have some key commands for that. I'm going to have to look into that. And I don't know if it was in your book, because I've been reading this and also I do a lot of web surfing, but I saw a kind of a hack for bookmarks in making JavaScript bookmarks, which I recently used for something. And basically it's kind of an advanced idea, but it's is this in your book, this idea, Nigel?
Well, the idea of bookmarklets is briefly covered,
mm-hmm.
But I agree with you, they're all over the web. And I think this is really one of the most fascinating trends we've seen in user interface technology for quite a while. There's an increasing number of ways that you can stuff JavaScript into your other people's web pages, and that really is the beginning of a very long trend, I think. Bookmarklets are an example, and there's another very popular extension called Grease Monkey, only recently released, which allows you to add little bits of script to a file, and then when you open somebody else's web page, it just changes the web page to suit you.
Right.
That's fascinating because it changes a web page from being sort of a published document produced by somebody else to sort of a card game almost, you know, where it's the user has as much control over how it looks as the person who developed it.
Now, can you tell me, have you done this? Have you have an example of using this feature for some site? And what kind of change would you want to make?
At the moment I'm fiddling with an example for the Linux Journal magazine. And you can, for example, if you don't like the sidebar that a website produces, or if you don't like the color scheme, or if you find that they tend to put ads in a certain spot at the top of the web page, then you can remove all that. Or you can use it to, if you're quite more advanced in your JavaScript, if you're almost a programmer, then you can really just grope all over the web page and pull out the bits that you want or insert pieces from other web pages that are elsewhere on the web. It provides a new point of integration for computer-based functionality that you're looking for. You don't have to stick to the links that other people have provided you.
Very cool.
So yeah, modifying.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of puts this idea that even the application can be in the hands of the viewer and not just the person that's in there, I should say. You know, I mean, it gives this idea that websites are more dynamic even than we really normally think of them, and being able to modify the content. I'm going to go ahead and start going to calls and finally get into content, the information from Pacific Grove. We're going to have Sari join us. Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi.
G'day.
What's your question?
Let's see. I am calling to get sort of consumer information, I guess.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. I am self-employed. I do writing. I'm working in the publishing industry, but not the graphics end. But I'm a Mac user, and basically because of that kind of background, I guess. And I have a 16-year-old going into 11th grade and a daughter going into 7th, and they live between my house and their father's. He has a PC. I have a G4. We're about to do a remodel, so I'm going to be moving off-site, and I need to be mobile. So I'm looking to buy something that can integrate once we're back in the house, and I have my son and daughter occasionally here, and the scenario of perhaps having three computers in the house. What should I buy?
Okay, so you're building a whole network of computers for your house.
I guess so, but first we're moving out of the house temporarily, and my kids go to their dad's house where there's a PC.
Okay. So what you're asking kind of when you move into your new place, what kind of setup should you make so that everybody has a computer?
That, and in the meantime, while we're mobile, you know, I need to get something because I'm going to be temporarily out of the house. I don't want to move my whole setup.
How mobile?
We're going to, like, move to another place for 4 months while a remodel goes on.
Well, you could set up your current computer at that new place. 4 months is enough time to want something that's pretty stable.
Are you worried about the files that your kids have? Are they using the computers for school?
Yeah, they don't really have files, very many.
So the fact that your ex has a PC and you're a Mac person, that's not too big of a problem then with the kids.
He hasn't been able to apparently download attachments, but maybe it's just because they don't know how. It seems pretty basic. I've done it.
Huh.
Okay, well, I don't really know how to address your question. Because it's such an open question. It's kind of like the philosophy of life, you know. I mean,
well, here, I'll narrow a little bit for
please
you.
Please do.
Some scenarios. I recently was in a local publishing house that had Mac and also has PCs in their administrative side. And everyone had these really cool-looking, kind of sleek, thin monitors. And then they had this unit that they could plug in. And then they could unplug it and take it with them. And mm-hmm. It was like a laptop mm-hmm. with a docking station or something. And it was like a Dell.
And it was a laptop?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a pretty expensive setup. Basically, you buy an external monitor, and then you get a laptop that has a docking station. And it's a pretty common way to do things. I happen to do that with a Mac as well. I use my laptop as my main machine.
You use it as your main machine, exactly. So you don't have to look at the little screen while you're at home. You can plug it into your docking station and use it like a desktop system.
So how about
which is very nice for you because you're moving.
Right. So if I got two or three of those once we're back in the house, could they be networked to have like common email and DSL and all that?
Yeah.
Very easily.
And so are you saying this is very expensive though?
Well, the
notebooks themselves.
Getting laptops in general is more expensive.
Yeah, the notebooks themselves might be expensive, but setting up a wireless network in your house, it's not that expensive at all. less than $100.
And so setting up, getting the laptops to hook together.
What's going to happen is this. The thing with a laptop is if you get the kind of lower cost laptops, they're not going to be as powerful as desktop machines. And if you get laptops that are as powerful as desktop machines, they're heavier and, you know, bulkier, and they're much more expensive. So it's kind of this debate whether you want to be going with it. You also can't upgrade laptops nearly as easily as you can desktop machines. I'm going to go ahead and say goodbye to you. I don't think I can really answer your question because it's not, it's kind of like a, you know, philosophy or something. I don't have a direct question from you. So I'm going to go on to the next call. So thank you very much for calling.
Thanks.
Good luck with the problem. We're going to go to, let's see, how about Aptos with Scott? Welcome to GeekSpeak.
Oh, good morning, everybody. Hey, I've been using Firefox for 2 or 3 years since you folks recommended it on the air, and I love the tab browsing, and I love the pop-up blocking, and I've heard that it's more secure of a browser than, say, Internet Explorer, and I'm wondering how that can be with something that's open source. You know, I'm not a programmer or a real geek, so I don't really understand how this works, but it seems like if the source code is available, then it would be easier to, you know, custom make. Just as people can write extensions, they can also, you know, write malicious things.
That's a great question, Scott. I'm going to let Nigel address the question and say goodbye to you because you're sharing a phone line. I want him to be as clear as possible. Thank you for the call.
Sure thing. Bye.
Nigel, did you get that question?
Yeah, sure.
Great.
I mean, I think that's a central issue surrounding Firefox browser and open source. And I think there's two aspects to it. The first is, can the browser itself be more secure than Internet Explorer? And the second is, are extensions safe? And for the first question, I think the answer is really, yes, it can be more secure, mostly because of the peer review process. Because the software is exposed to the whole world, you can have people look at it who actually don't care about it at all. They don't care whether it's good or not. All they want to know is whether it works. And that independent view makes it very easy to pick up bugs. And that independent view is something you don't get with a product that's developed in-house like Microsoft's Internet Explorer.
Well, you do get, to some degree, that. You get that called the QA department, and there's a major, you know, it's a major part of software development is QA, but it just happens to be normally those resources
which
are pretty...
Which is quality assurance.
Right, which, you know, quality assurance, of course, they're limited because the company can only afford a certain setup. But the great thing with an open-source product, especially one with being used so widely, is that your QA is... tens of thousands of people.
That's right.
Is that
also, the diversity of opinion you get is wider too, because you can get feedback from people whose jobs don't depend on saying that it's a good product. That's a very powerful way to get good quality criticism, I think.
I just want to say real quick before we move from that point that Firefox is not being released as an end product to people. It's not like they're not testing it first. It's released in beta form,
right,
where they gather feedback and work on stability issues and that sort of thing.
In fact, most of its life has been in a beta
form. So typically when you download a new version, that has already been tested by a lot of people who know that they've downloaded a beta to test.
Yes, it's very, very heavily tested. And, of course, another aspect of the product cycle, too, is that Microsoft is in a position where they have to constantly move on to the next sale. And so with a big product like Internet Explorer, and browsers are very big products, if you're a commercial company, you just can't turn around and spend, you know, years or, you know, easily years looking backwards at the product to see that every single aspect that you hoped worked still works. You have to move on to something else that makes money. And it's natural that the Internet Explorer browser... parts of it will just not get the attention that they really deserve because the web developers and other technologists in Microsoft are moving on to something else.
That's a really good point. They have to make another product because they have to make money. And to make money, they've got to make enough feature sets that the new product's more appealing than the old. And so you don't see that kind of crawl towards the better product.
Yeah.
You see jumps to the better product
that you have to pay for. Microsoft has responsibility to improve Internet Explorer because they force themselves into the market. That's just my own opinion.
That's like it's not a financial responsibility.
It's more of an
ethical one. and that's one of the major reasons why Firefox is taking such a foothold now on growth and in development. It's got
features that IE doesn't have. It's got tab browsing, which is a big one. It's got, I like alpha PNG support, which is PNG is another form of images like JPEG or GIFs. It's just that PNG supports this idea of having multiple shades of transparency. So you don't have those jaggies when you pick a PNG transparency over another image. Very cool. We don't see it much because IE doesn't support, well, it kind of supports, but not the right way.
It doesn't support RSS?
Well, it doesn't have, you know, as great simplification as it does in Firefox. But you were saying about extensions being safe. Now, what about extensions being safe?
Yes, well, that's a much bigger picture, really. Of course, extensions are very flexible things, and so they can do absolutely anything to your computer if they happen to be written that way. And so it all comes down to trust. Who do you trust to put it... fairly complex piece of software on your computer, and who do you not trust? And at the moment, there are several reasonable forms of trust that you can have that will let you feel comfortable about most of the extensions. First of all, if you go to the Mozilla Foundation's update website, the one that's brought up when you click on the Get More Extensions link under Tools Extensions in the browser, that website is run by the Mozilla Foundation, and since they make the product, if you can't trust them, you can't trust anybody. And so anything that you download from their website is probably going to be safer than downloading just from a random website around the internet. Secondly, most of the extensions, in fact, as far as I know, all of them so far, are also open source. And so you don't get into this situation that you have with viruses, where you download something that nobody's ever looked at and nobody understands the interior workings of. Extensions are exposed to view just like everything else in Firefox. And so if somebody puts up an extension onto the web that's malicious or otherwise bad for you, then you get into this situation that, you know, we had in the Middle Ages where if a thief arrives on the scene, everybody nearby says, "Stop thief."
Right.
And it doesn't... Yeah, it doesn't take very long before our malicious extensions like that would disappear. And we haven't had any malicious extensions yet, and I think we're unlikely to have any for a long time.
We're talking about the Mozilla.org product, the Mozilla Foundation product, Firefox, a web browser, standalone web browser, very appealing, really nice browser. I happen to use it all the time. You can learn more about this product, Mozilla.org, M-O-Z-I-L-L-A.org. Of course, you can go to geekspeak.org, and while you're there, go ahead and send us a question via email. We have the Firefox expert, Nigel McFarlane, author of Firefox Hacks by O'Reilly, on, and the phone numbers, there's nobody waiting, 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Of course, you can use the Internet. Go to geekspeak.org. You can see a little bio about Nigel, some links about Firefox, and of course you can click on Contact Us to send us email to ask questions or comments about the browser or about Mozilla in general. So the other side of the browser for me as a web developer is this idea of being able to understand how things are done, and it's really important when you're doing development, for example, in a website, to try to figure out why something's not happening the way you expect it to happen, and it's basically a bug in your own website. If you've ever gone to a website with like a broken link is a perfect example where if you click on that link, it doesn't work. But there's a lot of formatting issues. And Firefox, because the development community are, I think, coming from web developers, there are a lot of extensions and support in the browser that allow you to develop better. Can you talk a bit about one of your favorites that you use for Firefox?
Sure. Sure. I mean, there two extensions that I think are absolutely vital for a web developer. That one's the Web Developer Toolbar, and the other one's called Live HTTP Headers. The Web Developer Toolbar allows you to turn on and off different pieces of styling information when your web page is loaded into the browser, and also lets you check your web page against standards with an automatic submission to a standards testing website. And the Live HTTP Headers extension lets you see the information that goes backwards and forwards between the web browser and the web server, which is really vital if you use cookies or form submissions or other forms of data backwards and forwards from the server to your client. And both of those extensions are really bringing into web developers' awareness the fact that a web browser is not just a viewing tool. It's also a testing tool. And we've been served really poorly with Internet Explorer in the area of testing. If you're a professional web developer or even an amateur one, you really need a proper testing tool in order to see just what the impact of your work is. And Firefox provides that. And the number of people I've seen who just do all their web development in Firefox and then at the last minute when they've got it all tested, move it over to Internet Explorer to see that it still works there in that older browser is really increasing, you know, because the testing environment is just much more pleasant if you're a web developer. You get more feedback. You can understand what's going on with the view source feature. You can look at the JavaScript console to see what's going on in your scripting. It just makes your life a lot less difficult. I recently was fiddling around with Internet Explorer again for the first time in ages, and I just was immediately frustrated by the fact that I couldn't dig any information out about what was going on with the page that I was making. I mean, that's not helping anybody, and it's certainly not helping the web become a more diverse and interesting place to be.
From Watsonville, California, Judith, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Yeah, hi. I'm a Mac user, and does Firefox work on the Macintosh as well as the PCs?
Sure does. Sure does, in Linux, and even some of the obscure platforms like Sun Solaris. You can use it anywhere. If you've got an older Mac, though, you might be in a little bit of trouble. You've got to have Mac OS X to really get going.
Yeah, I have a OS 10.3 something.
Yeah, it works really well. I've got a Mac in front of me with OS 10.3, and Firefox, I mean, lately I've been noticing that Firefox is much more stable than Safari. Safari crashes on me sometimes. Even though Safari is a great browser, not available for Windows users, of course, I think Firefox is a more stable browser, and some of the controls that you can do in Firefox, if you're I kind of put it this way, if you're kind of geeky in nature and you're on a Mac, do Firefox. If you really don't want to worry about anything, you could stay with Safari. But if you know, I recommend trying it. You might like it.
And you can go to firefox.com now.
Oh, you can go to
Firefox. And get a link there, yeah.
Oh, that's very cool. All right, we're going to take another call. Thank you very much for the call, Judith. Okay, from Santa Cruz, Marty, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had a question about your password manager that I can't seem to find in 1.0. So if I want to delete old passwords or just work with that, I can't seem to manage anything anymore. Is that somewhere buried in there?
Yeah, I mean, the password manager is still there. In the Mozilla application suite, the older product, it was sitting directly in the tools menu, but it's not anymore in Firefox. You have to go to the options dialog box, so that's tools, options, and then click the privacy padlock icon on the left. If you do that, you'll see in the center of the pane a saved passwords entry, and click the little plus next to that, and you can click the View Saved Passwords button, and up will come all your passwords.
You know, that's something. Marty, that's an interesting question, because it's something I rarely use, but I'm kind of frustrated it doesn't work the way I want it to work, and should just go there. But basically the idea is you go to a website, like I have a Yahoo Mail account, hundreds of sites probably, at least 50 sites that have different passwords. And so you enter it, and it asks you, do you want to save this? And you say yes, and sometimes you say no and everything. And the cool thing, of course, with the manager is that you can do that. So it's still there. It's just under options security. Is that
If at some point I said, no, never for this site, and then I change my mind and want to now save a password for that site, I'm kind of frustrated with how to find that. Is that in that area as well?
Yes, you can change all that. You can change whether a site is allowed or not using the whitelist that's in the Save Passwords dialog box.
You know,
just need to have a bit of a poke around in the options dialog box.
Thank you for the call.
Perfect.
This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. We have been speaking with author of Firefox Hacks by O'Reilly, Nigel McFarlane from Australia. Nigel, I want to thank you very much for participating on GeekSpeak today.
Great talking to you, Lyle.
The geek this morning was Sean Cleveland. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of Online Tonight with David Lawrence and is used by permission. For those of you that called in, thank you very much for participating. For those that are listening, thank you for participating as well. Next week on Geek Speak, we will be talking about Basecamp, good application development, why browsers are important, but because of what you can do with them. Coming up next is Open Road with Matt Pierce, and at 1 p.m., Two Steps in the Blues with Charlie Lang. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, Santa Cruz, KBDH San Auto, on the web at kusp.org. Thanks for listening to Geek Speak.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Bush was in suburban Washington pushing